after today, I can safely say that I talked to the sheriff. I didn't talk to no deputy. Oh, no, no. Hello, my name is Craig S. Seaman, and welcome to Worcester Rock and Roll Confidential, where whenever we meet, we talk to a prominent pillar of society about the only true thing that matters in life, the sanctity of rock and roll. So for the next 22 minutes, give or take, there's no talking shop, no hidden agenda, no politics, just rock and roll. And our first guest, who's also our last guest and our only guest, needs no introduction. He's one of the tallest men in the Commonwealth and one of the coolest guys on the planet. And he's also the nicest guy you'll ever meet. I welcome Worcester County Sheriff and rock and roll lover Lou Evangelitis to the studio.
Craig, that is about the best introduction I could possibly have asked for, so I maybe should leave now. But thank you, and I share your passion for rock and roll. I just finished Springsteen's autobiography, which he just came out with last year, two nights ago. So at the end, he kind of concludes with his sort of feelings that, you know, his life has been about a pure devotion to rock and roll and living that kind of life, but with true integrity and passion. So I'm with you on that. I'm excited about this podcast. Thank you for having me on today.
And you touched on already Springsteen.
Yeah.
Are you a Springsteen fan, Lou?
Yes, very much so. I mean, there's Springsteen fans I know that'll put me to shame, and they'll go through 20 or 30 concerts they've seen. I've probably seen Bruce 10 times, and I know his musical, you know, his sort of variety of albums through the years, so I've listened to a lot of Bruce, and I love Bruce, but I wouldn't put him in my top five, but I love the guy. I think he's a great writer. He's a great American rock and roller. You'd probably put him on a Mount Rushmore of American rock and rollers, and of course, Elvis would be the first.
Absolutely.
And maybe only if you had one, but Bruce is definitely a legend, and I've been blessed to see him many times, including here in Worcester several times.
Yes, he opened two tours in Worcester.
Yeah.
He opened the Tunnel of Love tour.
Yep, I saw that.
And he wrote, opened the Lucky Town, Human Touch.
He also did a solo tour here once when he did play just piano, and he played the Centrum out just
Devils,
the piano.
Devils and Dust, and I saw him like five times on that tour.
Yeah.
And the one at the Centrum or the DCU Center was actually the worst.
Really?
He was in a bad mood.
I only saw him once on that tour, and that was the one.
That was
great.
I know a lot of fans were actually turned off by that show because he actually told someone to not do something nice to themselves.
Well, he definitely told the crowd to quiet down because he wanted complete silence.
And he used a bad word. I think he had a fight with Patty that night.
Okay.
That's me.
Because I heard the person he yelled out to was you, but I didn't want to go there tonight. But
well, actually, I've been on his radar. You know, last time I saw him, I saw him march for the Broadway.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet.
And I was hanging outside, and actually, I took a plane there. And because of those crazy snowstorms, my plane was canceled a day. And when he came in, the stage door, which is this little rinky-dink door on the side of the theater, I was yelling at him, "Bruce, I trekked through the snow from Worcester, Massachusetts. You opened two tours there. Don't ignore me now." And he gave me a look like, But being that we don't usually have someone of your stature in our studio, I do have to ask, I shot the sheriff. Do we prefer the original Bob Marley version or the Eric Clapton version that probably more people are familiar with in the States?
Well, for me, it's no-brainer. I mean, it's the Bob Marley version, and I think the reason I knew the Clapton version, because when I was in, I think, 7th or 8th grade, I think it was like 1974, Clapton came out with it. Everybody was singing it, and then I drilled down, as you usually do when you're younger, and you figure out where it really came from, and I far prefer Bob Marley's version.
Now, the narrator of that song confesses to shooting the sheriff and says, and I quote, "But I didn't shoot no deputy. Oh, no, no, no." Either way, Bob Marley and or Eric Clapton is in a heap of trouble, right?
Well, I don't particularly like the tenor of the song or the message, but I think I understand where he came from in Jamaica, and there was a lot of turmoil and corruption in government, and I think that was more about a rebellious thing about that country, not about American justice system.
Now, the $64,000 question, the first one. Now I'm showing my age, even though $64,000.
Yeah, I never heard of that.
Was before my time. What is a better sheriff song? I Shot the Sheriff or Dylan's Knocking on Heaven's Door?
Well, you know, I'm going to go with Knocking on Heaven's Door. I think that's I love that song. I love that record it came out on. That was kind of a great record for Dylan. And he also has a song, what's the one he wrote about the boxer there, Hurricane Carter, and he mentions the sheriff in that song too. So he throws the sheriff into some of his songs.
And you think about it, because Knocking on Heaven's Door was written for the movie Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
That's right.
And they recently made a movie, The Hurricane.
That's right.
With
Denzel Washington.
Denzel Washington. And in both cases, the songs are better than the movie.
I know.
I mean, you think about it. I have never seen good accolades from Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
Never.
But that song, instant classic.
Absolutely.
Instant classic.
No, Reuben Hurricane Carter, that song was, I guess it actually gave him a second trial when it first came out, and it turned out, I think he was convicted again, so, in the end of the day. But it's a great song, and when Dylan makes allusions to, you know, I Ain't No Gentleman Jim, I mean, that's an old boxer from the 1920s, I mean, he really was all over the place, like, made amazing musical references
in
his songs.
And Dylan is, not to interrupt you, Lou, do you don't mind if I call you Lou, dude?
Call me anything you like, Craig.
Okay. This is going to be fun. Mr. Lawman. No, Lou. Dylan's one of your favorites.
Absolutely. Could be if I had to pick one artist who I would say 100 years from now people will absolutely be quoting and listening to, it's Bob Dylan, because his poetry, his music and his poetry is just second to none. And I couldn't think of a more fitting person to receive the first musician to receive the Nobel Prize in Literature than Dylan. It made perfect sense. And I always say this, Craig, and you'll appreciate this, but I say, you know, sometimes you can divide the world into this and that. I think one of the big ones is people who get Bob Dylan and people who don't.
Right.
And a lot of people don't. His voice is raspy. They don't quite get it. But his poetry, his songs, his records are my favorites. I think I mentioned it before we came on. I mean, Blood on the Tracks.
Right.
If I had one record, that would be the one, because every time I hear it, I hear something different. You know, I can listen to Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts, and I can listen to it 100 times, and every time I listen to it, I hear something different. That's a mark of something pretty special.
And you think of Dylan, people sometimes lose track of this. He was a young guy when he came out.
19 years old when he moved to New York City, and he was hailed as a poet of his generation at 19.
And the amazing amount of material was
incredible.
I mean, and you think about it, that was actually a characteristic of most of the rock and rollers out there. They would put out two albums a year.
Well, Dylan was the first, and the one thing he changed, and it really became a big part of the 60s rock and roll, was Dylan was, I believe, the first artist to put his lyrics in his record. The jacket. Remember when the Beatles came out?
Absolutely.
It was Dylan who was the first one to put the lyrics mattered. And then, you know, as well, in the 60s and 70s particularly, everybody put their lyrics in their record, their record sleeves, because it was an important part of what was happening. I think Dylan was the first lyricist that really mattered to people, and he really elevated the genre, you know, to be something special. So I find Dylan a special place in my heart for me because he's so beautiful. And you mentioned his early records, like Freewheeling. You can start in 1962,
Absolutely. And
you can go right to his most recent stuff. He's a magical... He's a magical American. I'll tell you, we're blessed to have him.
And I was thinking, I haven't thought about this for a while, but I used to say Mick Jagger is probably the person who's on the planet who's been the coolest the longest,
mm-hmm.
because he was cool when he was 17.
Sure.
But I mean, Dylan is in that class. He's always been cool, and seeing the recent Bowie exhibit in Brooklyn, he was always cool. I mean, he was cool
definitely.
And he's still an icon.
I'll tell you about Mick Jagger. It's incredible. I saw the Rolling Stones when I was in college in 1981. I thought they kind of became a little bit of a nostalgia act, so I don't like nostalgia acts. I love a lot of current music, so I wouldn't see them, and I happened to be in a traveling, and the Stones were playing, and I happened to go see them about 2 years ago. And I'll tell you right now, I was astonished
this
at
was
how...
At the Garden.
No, this was out in Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
I saw them in Ohio Stadium.
The last tour they did, right?
I just happened to be there. I thought, well, why wouldn't I go? And I got to see Mick and Keith. Keith and Charlie Watts and Ronnie Wood all together again, and they were unbelievable.
And Mick Jones came out, didn't it? Was that when Mick Jones?
He wasn't at that show, but it was incredible to see how great they looked, how good they sounded. It was remarkable, and you got to think now. Here's great little story for rock and roll. In 1969, they asked Mick Jagger, they asked John Lennon about the Beatles breaking up. Maybe it was 1970 when they made the official announcement.
Right.
And they said, John Lennon, they said, you know, how could the Beatles have broken up? He said, don't ask me how the Beatles have broken up. Ask me how the Rolling Stones haven't. That was in 1970. They're still playing now.
Yeah, and I saw them last tour, the last time they played at the Garden. And thinking the same way you're thinking. And it was amazing. And and his music catalog, so you can't beat.
There's no band that'll ever have the longevity and the quality and the impact that the Stones have had. They just won't. I mean, rock and roll isn't that way anymore. So that's probably the last of the greatest bands that'll ever be. And if you've ever seen them, you're blessed. And it said they still look good. I mean, we laughed after the show. We said, I think Keith Richards is actually aging backwards because he looked 70 when he was 30. Now he's 70, he looks 69. So he's aging backwards.
The real Benjamin Button.
He's amen. Amen.
And you think about the stuff. Well, here's a real quick pop quiz question.
Mm.
Your opinion, which is not wrong, unless I'll tell you it's wrong. The last great Stones album.
Who? You know, I don't think I bought a Stones album since Tattoo You, which I absolutely loved. And of course, I can rattle off, you know, Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed, Exile, all those 70s records, all the way through Some Girls, which is incredible.
Some Girls.
I love Tattoo You. I can't think of.
I think Some Girls. The proper answer was Some Girls.
Okay, Some Girls was incredible.
Tattoo You is
Tattoo You was a solid record,
album,
yeah.
But it's the last masterpiece.
Yeah, I can't.
Is Some
Girls. Like, there was many after that.
Which is still a cool album.
Very. And I'll mention this, too. If you haven't read My Life by Keith Richards, it's his autobiography. I read it last year. It's unbelievable. It is so beautifully written. And his memory, remarkably, he must have recorded everything. But My Life by Keith Richards, definitely worth a read.
Better than Springsteen's book?
Yes. Yes, I thought it was. And Springsteen's book was great, too.
Yeah. Now, what is a better Breaking the Law song? Judas Priest Breaking the Law or the Bobby Fuller 4? I Fought the Law.
Well, I'm going to call I Fought the Law the Clash version of I Fought the Law, which was the best version of that song. So,
and you've seen, and I know you've seen the Clash at least once.
Oh, three or four times. And I saw Joe Strummer solo. I saw him at the EM Lowe's.
How great was that?
Just before
show?
He died,
I
it
know.
Was un. It was unbelievable. The second set he came out and played all Clash. I was slam dancing. People were crowd surfing. It was mayhem.
Bob too. And
it was you were at that show?
I was at that
show. One of the best shows I have ever seen in my life.
That was one of those shows where you were at, and you're just looking at the people around, and you say to yourself, there could not possibly be anything cooler happening on the planet.
No, I agree with you.
Seeing Joe Strummer. At EM, I'm showing my age at the Palladium.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, shortly after that,
he died of a heart attack at 52. But you know what was amazing about that show, Craig? If you were there, I'll never forget this. Now, there's a man that really, in a way, kind of defined punk rock because there were bands before him, the Ramones, of course, bands like that. But nobody took it to the level of Clash because they were melodic. I mean, they were like a pop band with core punk, you know? So I remember when Strummer came along and, you know, they played that show and everything like that. You got to see them on that level. But he was just an unbelievable performer. To get to see him, that show, the things he must have experienced. I remember that show. People were jumping out of the audience on the stage. There was no security.
Absolutely.
People were jumping on the stage, grabbing the mic, singing with him, and he stood there didn't care at all. Then they'd do a backflip off the stage, and it was chaos, but it was like crazy good chaos. Like, nobody got hurt. Everybody,
absolutely,
you know, people think slam dancing was violent. It never was. If you were in the true punk era, people did it, and if you fell, they immediately picked you up. It was a very supportive environment. It was kind of an unusual thing, but it seemed on its face to be kind of violent, but it really wasn't. There was an undertone of sort of support of each other. So I always loved that. But that show,
were you a big slam dancer or body surfer?
Not really. I just happened to go to punk shows, and that would break out from time to time. And if it broke out around me, I wasn't going to run away. So
I was always worried about losing my car keys. And now today I would be worried about losing the phone.
Right. Well, it was more like, you know, you just kind of bounced around off people. And being 6 feet seven, I wasn't too worried about it.
No, you certainly wouldn't have to worry. And What song is a better prison chain gang song? Sam Cooke's Chain Gang or The Pretenders Back on the Chain Gang?
Two absolutely co-equal great songs. I wouldn't pick one or the
good
other.
Answer.
Cooke unfortunately died at a very young age. Yeah. He got shot mistakenly at a hotel. I think he was in like Memphis.
Yeah.
What a talent. What a voice. Pretenders. I saw them in a very small show the day before Live Aid. I was living in Philadelphia. They hadn't played together in years.
Yeah.
They came to this show, this place called the Chestnut Cabaret in Philly, and they did a surprise show for free. And
wow.
I got like 300 people got in. I got to see them at that show, and of course they sang Chain Gang, and that's
I think I saw
that was a song that made them. That song made them.
Well, I mean, to me, and I show my age. I have. If you go to my car now in the parking lot, you will find a cassette of the first Pretenders.
Ooh, great record.
To me, one of the great debut records, and not that this was on my list. I always considered Chrissy Hynde one of the great rock and roll chicks, and I don't use the term chicks mm-hmm. in a derogatory fashion.
Right.
Who do you think are some of the great rock and roll women that we have seen?
Oh, wow.
And we don't have to go through the whole history. In the last 30 or 40 years.
I'll tell you my favorites, because I think of women. Yeah. Like, I am very passionate towards the folk scene, like Joni Mitchell to me is an all-time.
One of the greats.
Susan Tedeschi from Massachusetts today with Derek Trucks. They play some of the most beautiful music I've ever heard in my life. I love, let me try to think. I mean, obviously, you got all the soul singers like Aretha and all those. So it'd be hard for me to pick. Rock and Roll Hard had some great tunes. The Wilson Sisters were great.
And Nancy definitely should be on the list. Joan Jett should be on the list.
Oh, yeah. No, there was
Deborah Harry's
one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There were so many, but I've probably been drawn more to the folk and the soul singers.
Which is okay. I mean,
and the country women are outrageously popular. I mean,
Dolly Parton's probably
my favorite.
I mean, of that group.
Oh, my God. And Loretta Lynn. And
Dolly.
Yeah, and all the people today in country is it's so funny because country is perceived up here in the north of being a southern thing and, you know, male dominated. But women have probably had more success in country music than almost any other genre, if you think about it.
Yeah.
If you look at the charts, Miranda Lambert from Carrie Underwood. I mean, women are huge celebrities in country music, and I love that.
Yeah, and both Miranda and Carrie have done multiple shows. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Miranda's played at the Hanover and across the street at the DCU Center, and I know Carrie's been at DCU Center.
I saw Carrie with my kids. We went to that American Idol tour when she was the American Idol, and I've even seen her once or twice since then, but I don't. The women in country, to me, that's some of the best music out there. And of course, I've been pointed out that Pink, who is probably one of my favorite artists of all time. If you haven't seen Pink, you have missed one of the great performers in the history of rock and roll. She is a rock and roll icon. I saw her at the Garden about 3 years ago. I didn't go this tour. But 3 years ago, I saw her fly through the air. She puts herself on equipment that carries her across. It's the most terrifying, amazing, mesmerizing show. And her music is second to none. Pink is a rock star.
That's amazing because Pink does do this circus.
She's unbelievable.
But she doesn't need to because she has a dynamite voice.
She has a great voice. Her song, she writes her own stuff. Her song catalog is unbelievable, and her performances are outstanding. I would put her in the top echelon of any rock star I've ever seen.
And one thing I've always wanted, one of my personal things I've always wanted to do, and I probably shouldn't say out there because someone will grab the idea. I went to school to be a writer, and one of my projects that is in a drawer is an unfinished script that I was writing on the life of Wendy O. Williams, the Plasmatics singer. And I always thought that Pink would be perfectly cast as Wendy O. Williams.
I could see
She has the look. She definitely has the swagger.
The attitude,
yeah. Pink is a great singer. And a necessary question, what song is a better jailbreak song than Lizzie's Jailbreak or AC/DC's Jailbreak?
You know, I cannot say Thin Lizzy's Jailbreak. I'm not familiar with it. I don't really know Thin Lizzy except for a couple of their songs.
You must know the tune.
I'm sure I do. You want to sing it for me?
Tonight it's going to be a jailbreak.
That helped.
screw that question.
I'd probably go with AC/DC on that one.
Okay. Well, what song is the better Time in the Big House song? Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison Blues or Elvis Presley's Jailhouse Rock?
See, you can't go wrong with any of these choices you give me because they're all-time classics for all the time. So, I mean, I can say both of those songs would be in almost anyone's list of top 20 songs of all time, anything Jail-related, top five. So I can go either way. Both unbelievable artists, unbelievable. So I did see Johnny Cash with June Carter. I was blessed to see them and in a pretty small club in Boston a few years before he passed away. Yeah. Remember he did those American recordings? He came back from the country and he did those like folky recordings in the 90s.
Did Nine Inch Nails.
Yes, he did. And I saw him during that. He had the American recordings like 1 through 5.
Yeah.
And I saw him, I think, right after release the first one with June Carter. It was it was a blizzard snowstorm. The place was only half full. It was down on Lansdowne Street. They changed the name, Venus de Milo, whatever. Saw him in that club. Johnny Cash, June Carter. It was the closest thing I've ever felt to seeing American royalty when it came to music. Those two,
right?
My God, what a blessing to see them.
That one of my regrets. And actually, Johnny Cash played at the Indian Ranch in Webster.
He did. I've talked to many people that have seen him there.
And this was when U2's The Roper was out.
Wow.
Which was the number one album in the country, and he did a song called The Wanderer, about like wandering in the wasteland, and reluctantly near the end of the show, he was saying, I was going to sing this song, but June said I should, it's the number one album in the country, I mean, talk about, but yeah, definitely one of the great legends of all
time. Well, you know, it's interesting, Craig, I go to Nashville whenever I can, because it's just a beautiful musical city, the talent there is unbelievable. If you go to the Grand Ole Opry, or you do a tour, or the Ryman, you'll see right away, you'll figure out the two preeminent country artists to this day who are looked back on in history. Hank Williams, obviously, you could make an argument, is the most important country figure just because of his influence. But Johnny Cash is right behind him. If you go there, the amount of museum space and amount of time given to him is second to nobody. So Johnny Cash will be historically looked upon as one of, if not the most important country star of all time. Even though people remember he had that phase where he kind of, like you said, he played the Indian Ranch. He kind of was in between careers and kind of his career was on a down path. And then he came back. And I think when it's all said and done, Johnny Cash will be.
Rick Rubin stuff with the American Recording.
That's right. All that stuff. And those records were incredible.
I mean, Rusty Cage, Soundgarden, Nine Inch Nails thing. I think they were scraping the bottom of
by
the
five.
By five.
Well, you know, he was dying in five. You could tell his voice was raspy.
Yeah, but start doing covers of Animotions, Obsession, and
No,
that's a joke, people. But that would actually be good, Johnny Cash. You're my ups. I can't do a Cash. You could probably do a Cash.
Well, he's got a song, "Will You Meet Me in Heaven Someday?" Yeah. He sings to June.
Yeah,
I think it was after she'd passed, and he was still around, and it's really moving. Even though his voice was gone, the passion, his life. If you've ever watched the YouTube videos, you should see the sessions that he did, like in his living room with people in Nashville. Oh my God! So he right to the end.
Even though he's considered country, he's as rock and roll.
Yeah, absolutely.
And as punk as you can get.
He was the original.
Yeah, he was certainly the original. And I've heard from a little birdie that you recently bought tickets for Dickie Betts.
I did. Very excited.
Now, Dickie Betts, of course, is one of the founding members of the Allman Brothers, and you're a big Allman Brothers.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk to Allman Brothers, for me personally, we all have bands that we just feel sacred about and love, like in our core. I mean, I probably started off and with my high school friends, and we listened to a lot of, like the Beatles and the Stones and the Who and the whole British influence. But when I really came back to the roots of American music, and I really got into blues and, you know, Muddy Waters and B.B. King and Elmore James and all those folks, the contemporary sound that took that was a Southern American band out of Georgia, the Allman Brothers. And I just became a huge fan of their music. I feel like they're spiritual. They kind of, what I found interesting is they took American blues, they superimposed it over jazz structure. You know, it's like Miles Davis Kind of Blue was the record that influenced them. They all were very democratic about who played what. But Dickie was the center of that whole sound. Like Greg was the voice, Dwayne was the most famous guitar player, but Dickie was the sound. And I got to see him on with the Allman Brothers over 20 times.
Wow.
And then when he was unceremoniously kicked out of the band. I've seen him about another 20 times solo. And he's a beautiful spiritual guitarist. I don't judge my musicians by their personalities, their personal lives, because if that was the case, we might not listen to anybody.
Yeah, why should you?
But I judge them by what they have to say through their instruments. And Dickie's been special for me, and he came out of retirement. I think Greg died
for
recently.
You?
No,
you
maybe. I feel like you could be.
Wow.
But I love Dickie. I've been watching his website like we do when you have someone you really love who's still around. And when Greg died, Dickie is essentially the only Allman Brother left because Jamoy, the drummer, hasn't played much lately.
Right.
So there are only two left. Dickie came out of retirement. I think he did it for the fans to say, I'd like to bring the Allman Brothers back one more time. He's playing about a dozen shows. I just saw one come online. I was planning a trip to Pennsylvania to the Peach Fest. And God bless, he just put online last week that he's going to play Hampton Beach Casino. And I grabbed three tickets in the third row, and I'm going to see Dickie at least one more time. And
not to pry into your personal affairs, who are you taking?
Well, I got a friend, two friends I've already asked about coming. They scooped them up, but I got to be careful because I got a lot more people I want to invite.
Put
and
me
I'm
on that list.
Putting the word out.
If this thing goes well, if we're still talking to each other, put me on the list. And Dickie, of course, is responsible for so many great songs.
Well, yeah, if you're not familiar, you know, everybody knows the Allman Brothers, but if you don't know Dickie, let me just say, the man wrote the biggest hit they ever had, Ramblin' Man. He wrote Blue Sky, which is one of the most beautiful guitar solos ever recorded. He also wrote, I could make a point, he might have written the only instrumental to ever be a top 10 hit, Jessica, which if you don't know it, you'll know it if you heard it. And he wrote so many of their other great songs. So he's really a very special artist, probably, in my opinion, the most underrated, influential guitarist of all time, because he, you know, and this is where I can start getting controversial with people, but, you know, the Grateful Dead and Jerry, I've seen them a dozen times. Very wonderful with their audience, but Jerry Garcia was a good guitarist. Dickie Betts was a revolutionary, beautiful guitarist. And I think Jerry's far more known, but I think Dickie, in my opinion, was a better player.
And as you mentioned, Jessica, that won the Grammy Award for Best Rock Performance in
1996. It did. That live version, like 15-minute live version.
Yeah. And
which I was there when they recorded at the Orpheum, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, that's fascinating. That's where it was recorded.
I believe the front cover shows them outside the Orpheum for
that album, and I believe that version was recorded there.
Yeah,
that's right in the Orpheum in that little alleyway.
Exactly.
and Dickie was only ranked 58 on Rolling Stone's 100th Greatest Guitarist of All Time. Obviously, we don't agree with that rating.
Well, I hope you join me in no. I couldn't disagree more. I mean, you know, hey, look, you're on the list. If he wasn't on the list, that would be a travesty.
Yeah.
Those lists come and go up and down. When it's all said and done and Dickie has left us, I think he'll be recognized by a lot more people than you'd think about how important he was.
And Dwayne, who unfortunately died in a motorcycle crash in 71 at the age of 24.
I know.
Was listed number two on that same list.
Yeah.
Behind Jimi Hendrix.
You know, it's funny. Dwayne used to always say, he goes, I'm the guy they know in the band, and Dickie Betts is the best guitar player in the band. Dwayne used to say that.
Now, as I said earlier, I don't want to talk shop, but you did tell me a funny story about because of your love of Allman Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
Because of, and songs that have been associated, or female names associated with Allman Brothers, you actually had a little bit of a problem.
Oh, God. If I ever meet, I met a real great reporter recently, and I'd known her for a while, but her name's Melissa. I won't give her last name just for her own protection. Yeah. But whenever I hear the name Melissa or Jessica, I can never remember them the next day because they're two of my favorite Allman Brothers songs that I carry. I know your name is either Melissa or Jessica. And people look at me like I have three heads. Like, how could you confuse those two? But to me, those names are almost identical because they're two of my all-time favorite songs. And the Allman Brothers had a way of naming their songs after women's names, even in memory of Elizabeth Reed. I mean, people might think, what song is that? You'd know it if you heard it, but people don't know that song. And it's another one named after a woman, Elizabeth Reed.
And you're more well-versed on Allman Brothers. Mm-hmm. And I have never seen the Allman Brothers. One of my big regrets.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and I think, unfortunately, the reason why I never saw...
I'm leaving now, Craig. Nice to see you.
I think the reason why I never saw the Allman Brothers, I unfairly linked them up with the Southern Rock of the 70s. You know, with Molly Hatchet and 38 Special, and which I did see, actually.
Yeah.
And even... Lead and Skin and after the
Well, they
crash.
Did. They the brothers did define and sort of brought Southern rock to the forefront, but they never considered themselves a Southern rock band. They're from Florida, and they consider themselves a blues jazz band that just happened to be from you know what they considered the South.
Certainly my ignorance on that.
Yeah, well, Skynyrd was a great. I hope you like Skynyrd. They were
I
good.
I liked them pre plane crash.
Okay, well, me too. Me too.
I'm amazed. Well, I don't want to say milking it, but I'm amazed.
I know, it's incredible.
But, I mean, some of those great albums and one of the great uses of music in a movie that I recall is...
Almost Famous?
Almost Famous is actually my favorite rock movie.
Well, that was based on the Allman Brothers and Skynyrd, depending on who you listen to. But,
and a great movie. I'm thinking of renting a movie theater close by to show Don.
But what were you talking about, reference?
Well, I was thinking how Lynyrd Skynyrd is prominently used in The Longest Yard. Burt Reynolds movie.
Right.
Which, for some reason, they made a remake with Adam Sandler. And
I never understood that
one. I don't know
who
in Hollywood thought Adam Sandler was a good sit-in for Burt Reynolds. But, like, they were playing, I think, Mr. Saturday Night Special on an 8-track tape was playing on his sports car, which he dived in. I forget what kind of car it was, a Lamborghini or something.
Well, there's another great scene. If you watch Field of Dreams, they have, when they're traveling around the country, and it's just when they pick up the hitchhiker who turns out to be the doctor, and they're playing Jessica as they drive around. That's kind of cool. Yeah, you'll see that next time you watch it.
Wow. So now I'm going to think of that. And as you mentioned, Blood on the Tracks is probably your favorite album.
Yeah, if you put, you know, as they say, you put a gun to my head or we don't do that. So let's say,
what are you doing?
Well, I'm trying to think of a way to phrase it. So, well, they usually give you 10 records if you're on your island. Yeah. But let's just say if I had to pick one record that is probably the one I've listened to the most in my life, I would say it would be Blood on the Tracks by Dylan.
And in my case, which it might be on your top 10 list, The Who's Quadrophenia, and you've seen The Who, I know.
Not only do I have seen The Who several times, but when CDs came out, Craig, and you probably remember when they came out, it was a big deal.
I was working on Strawberries.
Okay, I finally got my DVD player. I was living in Miami. It was 1987. I was probably late to the party on that because I didn't have any money. I was just out of law school, but I finally bought my first CD player, and I went out and bought two CDs because I couldn't wait to hear them. Quadrophenia was my first CD, and also Beethoven's Ninth Symphony.
Oh.
Those are the first two things I went out and bought because I wanted to hear them without the scratches, without the air, and I'll never forget that sound coming out. Oh, my God. Unbelievable.
Well, I mean, like I said, Quadrophenia is my favorite. I've seen The Who play that in its entirety two or three times.
I saw them. They came to Worcester, and they played the DCU
like
in 1996.
Yeah.
And they did a quadrophenia. It was one of the bands when
Gary Glitter.
Yes. But it was when they first started doing, I don't think before that had happened much. Now everybody's playing album tours.
That was one of the first.
I saw The Who on that tour, that tragic tour where the Cincinnati incident happened. I saw them in Boston. That was 1979.
December
16th. 1979.
I was there.
I almost died. I hitchhiked home from that show.
I was at that show.
It was one of the coldest days of the year, and I hitchhiked back to Amherst.
It was one of the most violent shows I've ever seen.
Really? Now tell me, because I don't remember that.
There was a lot of negative energy.
Oh, it was,
I mean, first off, I was still in high school, and this was the time I bought my tickets. I had an uncle. I still have an uncle. Uncle Peter Zona. Who had an in on Gracia tickets on Main Street.
Mm.
And this is when we used to buy tickets from travel
agents. Oh, of course. That's exactly right.
And I remember when the tickets went on sale, I got out of my geometry class, used the phone near the office at Burncoat High, and called my uncle to see if he could get some Who tickets. And he did. He ended up getting four. My mom went, my sister, myself. And you got to realize, after that horrible thing happened in Cincinnati, no one, and Who tickets were hard to get.
Oh, God, yeah.
And no one thought the show was going to happen.
Let me stop you one second, Craig. It's interesting. They canceled one show after that happened in Cincinnati. Do you remember the show they canceled?
No. The
show,
Providence, wasn't it?
I had tickets to Providence.
Because they just remade
them. They canceled Providence, and I had to go and buy them from a scalper for $40, which is all the money I had in the world. I had to go to a scalper at UMass and buy a ticket for $40.
Which was a lot of money back then.
It was all the money I had in the world, but I had to see The Who. So I took a friend, we both bought a ticket for $40. We took a bus to the concert in Boston, and we hitchhiked home, and it was like below zero, and I got home at like 5 in the morning. I almost died. It was that scary. scary. Yeah. But not to interrupt you, but that was the show. Yeah. I had to go to the Boston show because the Providence show was canceled that term.
Yeah, and if you remember, oh, gee, I got actually a few good stories. I'll make sure I can tell the ones I can tell. But so there was a lot of tension.
Yes, of course.
And I never saw the Garden so packed. That place was packed to the rafters. And which I always thought was bad taste. So we're talking roughly 2 weeks after what happened. 11.
Was it that soon thereafter?
Yeah, wow. I mean, I think December 3rd.
For anyone who might not remember, what happened was the Who used to have a general. They had a couple shows that stupid enough to have a general admission. And in Cincinnati, they had thousands of kids ready to go. They opened up the gates and they just flew in and they trampled. 11 young people got trampled to death.
And,
it was unbelievable.
Like, it was horrible. Yeah. And this was people like you could easily be.
Easily.
You or I. And the thing was, and what happened was, to be more specific, the Who, I mean, general mission for a Who show is insane to start off with. And what happened, and everybody wants, of course, the best seats.
Exactly.
And they were doing their sound check.
Oh, that's what set it off.
So what happened was, they heard the sound check. There was, I think, only two doors open.
Mm.
And hopefully nothing like that will ever happen again. But it was horrific. And if I recall, the Who didn't know it happened until after the show.
I believe you're right, yeah.
I mean, I don't know how you break that to. And, of course, they were all beside themselves. So,
well, I did see the Who. Yeah. I think it must have been general admission because I saw them in 1982 in Shea Stadium. They played their only show with The Clash. And it must have been general admission because I remember driving down with a bunch of buddies at UMass, got tickets on the street, and got in. And I was in the second row. I remember seeing Roger Daltrey, like, my God, with Pete Townsend. And I remember the bodies. It was so hot and it was so crazy.
Yeah.
And people were passing out. They were passing the bodies to the stage where I was because it was too far backwards. I just kept passing bodies over my head that were passing out.
Yeah.
And they were like just too much drinking or something. But I'll never forget that. I was so close to the stage that they were passing the bodies. Oh, I was the tall guy passing the bodies to the EMTs who couldn't get into the crowd.
Well,
so.
I saw the Who on their first of many farewell tours, the same one you saw them on, December 11th across the street at the Centrum. You were in the second row. I was in the front row. And that was the first of two times that I met Pete Townsend.
Oh.
So I got you on that one.
I never met Pete.
No, I met Pete twice, and I met Entwistle once at St. Morgan's Cove, of all places.
Playing there?
He did a show probably a year or two before he died.
No kidding.
A very sloppy, garage band type of show, and he was the most generous guy.
Whoa.
He would sign anything, pose for pictures.
What made him so amazing, if you know the Who, they were so famous live, is that they were famous for smashing their instruments.
Right.
Townsend's smashing his instruments. Daltrey's flipping the mic around his head. Keith Moon is dumping his drums everywhere. And Entwistle was famous for standing there, still as a board, and just playing bass while the whole chaos was happening. Remember how he was famous? His hair was coiffed perfectly, and he'd just stand there playing bass, and he'd never move. And it was so different because the rest of them were just out of their minds. And he was so famous for being like the rock of the band.
And the rock or the ox of the band. To me, he was, I mean, I think Keith, definitely the best drummer.
No question.
And I would say Entwistle. In my opinion.
I am with you on
that. Best basis.
I'm with you.
And I'm obviously a big Townsend fan.
But I agree. That backbone of that band was unbelievable. Between Tommy and Quadrophenia and that whole era when they, with Who's Next between. Nothing like it. It was, I always said, I believe you can make an argument the Who created rock music because it wasn't rock and roll. And the way I define rock music, it's not danceable.
Right.
You really didn't dance to you don't dance to Quadrophenia. You listen to it, it's rock music.
Now, we'll be wrapping. Wow, we've talked a while, but we're still good. Is it going okay? We'll talk a few more minutes. We'll have to decide what they want to
do. Sure.
Because there's a few things I want to touch. Roy Orbison.
Oh, my God, yeah.
You did have the luxury.
I saw Roy. To me, talk about the Pavarotti or, Caruso of rock and roll. Roy Orbison's vocals influenced everybody. He was one of the first to truly sing, put his heart into his songs and be vulnerable. Bruce Springsteen said he was deeply influenced by Roy. And I actually saw him, I only saw him once. It was at the grand opening of a pavilion in Miami. I was a state prosecutor in Miami. They opened up a park in 1987. Roy Orbison did it. I went. I remember, again, I went by myself. I just strolled, and it was free. it was unbelievable to watch the generations of people like holding hands and hugging, from old Cuban couples to young couples from probably from Miami, and it was so beautiful. And then I got really into Roy Orbison after that, and I was so excited. I had tickets to see him at the channel in Boston. He died 2 days before that show.
Oh, what a heartbreak.
He died 2 days before that show, and it was in 1989 December of 1988. I think it was December 9th of 1988.
Wow.
And I couldn't wait to see him again, but I thanked that Lord that day. I said, thank God I saw Orbison, because in the grand scheme of my life, again, he'd have to be one of my 10 favorite artists just because his music is so beautiful and harmonic, and he's just, and we talked about earlier about that Black and White special he did. So nice that those great stars paid tribute to him before his untimely death, because he was just coming back with the Traveling Wilburys. He was on his way back. U2 covered it, wrote songs for him, and then he was gone just like that.
Yeah, what a shame. And Channel, great club.
Oh, yeah.
Saw the Cramps there. I think that was the last show I saw there on Halloween night.
I saw Jimmy Cliff there and Black Uhuru, some of my old reggae days.
And you said you were a state prosecutor in Miami.
I was,
shop, but did you put Tony Montana away?
I did not. I'd like to take. Yeah, he was a little before my time.
And when you say Roy Orbison, sure, it wasn't Dean Stockwell lip syncing.
It was Roy Orbison.
Okay. And one thing of note in your career, when your career actually segs into the rock and roll world, is when you were a state rep, and you did a wonderful job as state rep. You did a wonderful job as state
rep.
I'll
take it.
You asked Governor Deval Patrick if he would prepare a proclamation.
I did.
Acknowledging, you tell the story.
Well, I'm happy to, because, I'll thank the Telegram for, they actually put this in their Living Arts page, not the political or news page, because, I was one of my most happy stories I ever got in a paper, because it had nothing to do with business or politics. It was pure entertainment, but it was the passion I had. Governor Patrick, I knew, was a B.B. King fan, and I wanted to recognize B.B. King, who, again, make an argument. If you talk to people who play guitar, I don't. That B.B. King changed guitar forever, because he was one of the first, if the first, not the first, to bend notes, and he changed music. So I always loved B.B. King like you can't imagine, and I thought it would be such an incredible honor to just meet the guy for a minute. So I talked to the governor, and he said, let's put together a proclamation, call it B.B. King Day in Massachusetts. You present it to him when he comes to Worcester to play the Hanover Theater. Wouldn't you know, it was the same exact day Bob Dylan, I believe, I saw Dylan there twice, but I think it was when he was doing his prep tour for the Newport Folk Festival, where he hadn't played in 30 years. So they were both playing in Main Street Worcester the same night. So I went to see Dylan first, and I had a friend call me when B.B. King came on. And then I left the Dylan show, went to the B.B. King show, and I talked to Troy Siebels, who's still the director over there. I set this up the week before, and he said, I'll talk to his manager. Yeah. He said to me, they're going to let you on the tour bus to present the proclamation to B.B. King after the show.
Bus.
So after the show, I go in the back, and I'm waiting, and they said, you can go on the bus now. It was B.B. King in the back of his bus all by himself, and I got to walk back there, and I gave him this proclamation. Let me tell you, Craig, he was so humble, so generous. He acted like it was the most impressive thing anybody'd ever given him. And I got to sit with B.B. King for like 10 minutes and just talk to him. And what a humble, beautiful man. It was one of the greatest moments of my life. I have that picture in my wall in my office.
Oh, you got a nice picture?
Oh, I got a pic. Troy took the picture, and it's out of focus. So if you see Troy, tell him he needs to work on his photography skills.
Can you blame the phone for that? Was that phone?
No, it was pre-phone.
Okay. Wow.
Yep. But that was, honest to God, in my whole life, I mean, a picture with B.B. King was something you dream about,
Now another Sophie's Choice question. What's better, B.B. King in the movie Into the Night or Albert Collins in the movie Adventures in Babysitter?
I'm going to go with Albert Collins on that one, because Albert Collins was, his death changed me going to concerts, because I had tickets to see Albert Collins, and I didn't go just before he died. I had something else come up.
What are you, like the Grim Reaper? Everybody died?
No, I just want to see a lot of people.
If Dickie Betts, God forbid.
Come on, I've seen Dickie 30 times, so I'm okay.
I'm going to blame
you. But Albert Collins, I did not go. He passed away, and I never saw him. And that made me go back and see every blues artist that came through this area from probably 19... I think it was he died in the summer of 86, and I think I saw every blues artist that came through Boston from 1986 to like 1996, and I saw a lot of them, and most of them are gone now, but thank God. But it was Albert Collins, because I never saw him. The master of the Telecaster, right? Never saw him play.
He's great in that movie.
I love him. He's his. You know that record? It was him. No, it was Albert King played with Stevie Ray. Okay. That's another great record, but Albert King was dead way before my time.
Yeah, wow. What a great story that is. And I did have a question I wanted to ask you, but hey, let's see. Well, okay. Do you credit anyone for instilling your taste in music?
You know, my dad was passionate about jazz music growing up, my grandparents played Greek music on that side. My grandparents played country music. But honest to God, I think I don't know where it comes from, because my passion exceeds any of the people in my family for music. But I think I've found a lot of friends in life, and they've kind of turned me on to different music. Like in high school, we all were into the British rock and roll scene. And then I got to college, and I had friends that were into country and jazz. And then I find people who are really heavily into blues. So I'd kind of like some of my friendships were based on music and different tastes, and I really got into a lot of different genres, but I don't think it was any one person. It was like probably 10 people that would, you know, I'd be really interested in music, and then I'd kind of go off on my own and seem like go in these deep holes. Sometimes I just listen to like one band or one music. There's a guy like Parker Millsap, for example. He's a 24-year-old folk singer, country, great player, playing in Boston. Like, I'll start listening to him. I'm going to see him next week. I'll probably listen to him, nothing but him all weekend. Just love to go into holes with artists and just keep listening to them over and over and over again. So
now, what were the first real concert or first few real concerts you saw?
You know, I mentioned I saw, we might talk about that, and you know, you got to be honest, so I can't tell you. I'd love to say I saw Led Zeppelin and really cool. I saw the Doobie Brothers, the first show I ever saw. Not bad, but I saw a lot of great shows right after that too. You know, I saw The Who pretty quickly thereafter, some great bands, but Doobies.
Who was my third show?
Oh, yeah. Who was your first show?
I would have to double check on the timeline, but it would have been either Rod Stewart on the Blondes Have More Fun tour, which was the Do You Think I'm Sexy album.
Sure.
And the Eagles' Long Run tour. Both of them got in, both in probably second or third row seats.
I was going to see the Eagles. I think that was the same tour. They played in, and nobody died in the show, but I was going to go, and our car broke down back in 1980. They played with Hart down in the Yale Bowl.
Okay.
And I think it was 1980, the summer of
78 or 79. Maybe
I think it was the summer of 80. But I didn't see the Eagles on that tour, and I actually never saw them ever. You know why? Their concert tickets became so expensive.
Well, they are the ones responsible for breaking the $100 barrier.
And I refused to go. I would not pay that money.
I remember that to the T, and we even had a tongue-in-cheek article about it.
Yep.
Because at that time, shows were... I mean, the first time U2 played at the Centrum, this June 28th, 1983, tickets were $12.50.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And that was a standard type of price.
That's
as you mentioned, $40 for your
it was unbelievable
your
amount of money.
Ticket, which was a scalper price.
Yeah.
And U2, and when the Eagles announced $100 for a ticket for the Hell Freezes Over tour, even Keith Richards said, you're paying $100 for a band rehearsing, because they weren't together for like 16 years prior.
That's exactly right.
And instead of the fans, the good fans saying this is ridiculous, I think they sold out like four shows at the Mansfield alone.
Well, I'm proud to tell you, they didn't get a dollar from me. I went to a Strawberries record store in Northborough. I was living in Framingham at the time. I got in line. I was in line with people. I went to a bank machine before I got there.
How much they were?
And somebody told me in line, the ticket's over $100. And I said, no, I'm just getting the lawn seats. They said, the lawn seats are $100. I got in my car and I went home.
Yeah.
I refused. I hate to say it if you're an Eagles fan. Look, I'm a big Glenn Frey, and I'll tell you, Don Henley's last record he did, that one...
Oh, yeah.
That country record he did, I can't remember the name of it now. It's County, where he comes from.
Yeah.
He's a great artist.
Yeah.
But they were in it for the money, and I was appalled by that.
But we gave them the money. Not you and I.
No, but people...
Not you and I, but I...
Sold out.
And I can't... And you know what? A cheap show now is $300.
You know, Greg, you're right, but let me tell you why it doesn't bother me anymore. Back in the day when we went to shows, artists, didn't make, they made the record, the money from selling records. So the tours were just to promote record sales. Yeah. So they gave the tickets away. Right. So you go buy their records. Right. Now they go, there's no money in the records anymore.
No.
Because of Spotify and Pandora. So what you do, they have to make it from touring. So I respect it now because we don't really pay much for the music anymore.
Right.
So you pay live. But that was when it was greed. It was just pure greed.
Awful. But I was amazed. I was dumbfounded.
I couldn't believe.
I was dumbfounded that they had the audacity to do that.
I couldn't believe it.
But I was amazed.
The people paid
the
it.
People actually.
It was unbelievable.
He said pretty much, yes, sir.
Not us.
Another. But, so who haven't you seen live that still exists that you hope to see someday? And who's long gone that you wish you
could boy. See? Well, the long goners are easy. I mean, you can make that list is endless, but start with Hank Williams. I mean, imagine just seeing Hank Williams. One time,
like Hank.
Oh, well, tall and skinny, but give me a cowboy. I can sing like him too. I could probably sing every Hank Williams song ever written. Obviously, Hank, Elvis Presley. Imagine seeing Elvis. My mother could have taken me to see Elvis. He was around when we were kids, but I never saw him. Of course,
not to interrupt you. And if I do, you can put the cuffs on me now. No one saw me come into this place today.
Trust me, the cuffs are going after we're over, done with the show. So
now, a lot of people are talking about, and I don't know if you've seen, there's a new trailer for A Star Is Born with Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga.
No, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it came out yesterday, and it's the movie's been made. This is the fourth time the movie's been made. And arguably, in my opinion, the best version is the one with Captain Nemo and Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, James Mason.
Oh, I never saw that.
Oh, Judy Garland. Great movie. And then there was the ridiculous one with Streisand.
I remember that one. And, was Redford in that? Oh, it's Kris Kristofferson.
And the great...
Who, by the way, was one of the greatest country artists, singers, writers of all time. People just don't remember that, that he became a celebrity when we were growing up.
Yeah.
And nobody realized he was a great country writer.
He had good luck. Especially
he did.
For that time, one of the cool guys. But one of the stories I remember, which breaks my heart too, and it's like one of the Beatles getting back together to get sorry. When they were making the Star Is Born, I think it was 77. I might be wrong on that. They offered the Kristofferson role to Elvis Presley.
Really?
And Colonel Parker told him, no, it's going to ruin your career. And I think that would have, if anything, extended his life 10, 20 more years. I think it would have been an incredible movie.
Well, you know,
it was a good act.
It's funny you said that. I just, not to extend this interview, but I just want to put this out. I love Elvis. You know, again, I find him fascinating because my kids know Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
You could make an argument, I'm making it now, that Elvis could be the most influential American who ever lived simply because he changed the culture wars. I mean, we didn't win the Cold War necessarily with weapons and armory. We won it with American culture, and Elvis Presley was the one who started, really, arguably, infusing what he did into the culture. He made young people suddenly big consumers. Young people mattered.
Right.
Before it was like, be quiet and
absolutely.
Be seen. So that sort of started the trend. But he when I saw his documentary recently, I learned something I never knew before, is that when Colonel Parker, by the way, kind of ruined him, although he made him, because he wanted Elvis Presley to be a money-making machine.
It was a carnival boxer.
It was a carnival, not an artist. Elvis was an incredibly deep musical artist, but Parker told him, I know how to make you money. And that was, Elvis wanted to go to Hollywood to be a celebrity, to be a movie star. You know why? Because there was no such thing as a rock star before. They didn't exist. Now everybody wants to be rock stars. But when Elvis came about, there was no such thing as a rock star.
Yeah.
So he thought the only way to start him was go to Hollywood.
Yeah.
And people who worked with him said he worked really hard.
Oh, no.
He knew his lines. He was a good actor.
Yeah.
But they didn't give him the right roles. And then, of course, the rest is history.
It became corny. And,
the rest is history.
And you can count, I mean, what, he made 20-plus movies?
I know.
And you can count the good ones on one hand.
Exactly.
I think we should probably wrap this up. I got a few goofy things, and if this doesn't work, we can
cut
it off the thing. When it comes to being a sheriff, are you more Sheriff Andy Taylor on the Andy Griffith Show? Sheriff John T. Chance, a.k.a. John Wayne in Rio Bravo? Sheriff Buford T. Justice and Smokey and the Bandit, or Sheriff Elroy P. Lobo from BJ and the Bear?
Well, I'm going to answer this, and it's an honest answer. I'm every bit of those, and it depends on what day of the week it is, because some days you got to be Buford, and sometimes you got to be Andy Griffith, and it depends on the day. But you got to be each and every one of those guys, depending on the occasion.
Okay, good answer. And although Wyatt Earp was a deputy town marshal in Tombstone, which do you feel is a better picture depiction of the gunfighter at the OK Corral? My Darling Clementine with Henry Fonda or Tombstone with Kurt Russell?
I don't think I've seen Tombstone, so
You saw the better of the two.
All right, okay. Well, that's why I'd go with the first, yeah.
Okay, well, Lou, anything else you want
to
say?
Wasn't High Noon about that? Was that also about?
Gary, I mean, if you
Gary
want
Gary Cooper, but
we can talk about...
What fight was that about?
That was
a fictitious?
Yeah,
okay.
I mean, and if you want to, just for the kids out there, the five, if you want to get into your Westerns, the best Westerns, High Noon, Shane, Red River, Stagecoach, and The Searchers. Three of those are John Wayne movies.
Well, I'm going to leave you with one last thing then. I actually saw a beautiful thing. God bless the, we got the Palladium now.
Yes.
They put a lot of money into it. They're
Absolutely.
Bringing new kind of shows. I went to a country show there last year, and John Wayne's granddaughter opened up the show with a band called Runaway June. And his
really?
Granddaughter, they are a beautiful band. They're three of the girls. They opened up the show, three young women, probably in their early 20s, opened up that show, and I love them. And she has
Runaway
one song
John?
Called...
Oh,
yeah, it has... They reference John Wayne in it, but his granddaughter plays in a country band now called Runaway June.
Oh, I wish I knew that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So I'd leave you with that one on your movies.
Well, Lou, it was an honor and a privilege, and it was a lot of fun. Thank you for joining
us. Oh, Craig, I had as much fun or more than you did. Thank you. Anytime.